Texas is asking the federal government to help them battle COVID-19. Specifically, the state wants federal resources to support testing centers, medical personnel, and more monoclonal antibody treatments. At the end of December, Texas was reporting more than 10,000 new COVID cases per day, up from 4,000 in November. That state's request comes after President Biden told some of the nation's governors that they're going to have to take the lead on fighting the virus.
Look, there is no federal solution. This gets solved at a state level. I'm looking at Governor Sununu on the board here. He talks about that a lot. And it ultimately gets down to where the rubber meets the road, and that's where the patient is in need of help or preventing the need for help.
Biden also reiterated some of the recent promises he made, including the federal government's purchase of 500 million rapid COVID tests. So we thought we'd take a look at the various ways the federal, state, and local governments can help the pandemic, what they can't do, and the role of the private sector and the rest of us. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Biden saying that states need to take the lead? The federal government can only provide support. What do you want to see Wisconsin do? What do you want to see the federal government do when it comes to providing testing, support for medical personnel, the treatments that are out there, promoting vaccines, requiring vaccines? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Robner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the host of KHN's What the Health podcast. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about some of the division of labor here. First of all, President Biden says the federal government can't do it all. It's done a lot. What do you see as the main role of the federal government in trying to help states deal with this?
Well, the main role of the federal government and its public health service is and has been to provide funding and support and expertise and guidance to state and local public health agencies, which, as the president pointed out in the clip that you played, is kind of where the rubber meets the road when it comes to public health.
There have been big questions about the government and how the federal government and how much its role is to provide stuff, whether that was PPE early on or then masks, vaccines, and now testing. How important is it for the federal government to distribute things or coordinate states as they seek out that vital material?
Well, there we've had, you know, going back to the beginning of the pandemic, this national stockpile that was generally created for the idea that if there was going to be an emergency, it was going to be on a state or regional basis, and that the federal government would maintain this stockpile of medical supplies and drugs and would be they would be available to be shipped as needed to places that were experiencing a temporary surge and need for those things. There are also people who can help, and obviously we've had the National Guard mobilized in many places. And there are also members of the federal public health service, uniformed public health service, who are available to come and help out. Of course, what we're seeing with the pandemic is that, particularly right now, everybody is having a surge at the same time. So it's difficult for the federal government to surge to, you know, one place. The model is more an outbreak in a particular state or a particular city or a hurricane or wildfires or something that does not affect the entire country at the same time.
The Biden administration has been criticized some for not having testing ready for a surge like this. So how big a problem do you see the availability of rapid testing in particular being right now, Julie?
Well, other countries have been distributing tests basically for free, or they're available, you know, for pickup at libraries or for a dollar at the grocery store. We have gone through the private sector, and this is partly because not so much the U.S. doesn't have a public health system. We do. It's because we don't have a public health, a public medical system. We don't have public health insurance the way many other countries do. So it's easier for them to sort of integrate their public health system with their sort of what we would consider our private health system. And we had private companies making these tests. And I think there was assumption, obviously wrong, last summer when things started to get better, that, well, why are we making all these tests when we're certainly not going to need them because there aren't that many people that have COVID anymore. That turned out to be an incorrect assumption. Now it takes a while for manufacturers of these tests to ramp back up.
Talking to Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, host there of the What the Health podcast, talking about the division of labor between federal, state, maybe local governments when it comes to all the things involved in trying to deal with this newest COVID surge. You can join in with your questions or your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Julie, states, we've got 50 of them plus some territories, Washington, D.C., in many ways going their own ways. What are you seeing when it comes to the range of state responses right now to this surge?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, it's difficult because we're having a hard time right now differentiating between sort of who has Omicron and who's vaccinated and who might be at less risk for severe disease and who still has Delta, which is still floating around and might need monoclonal antibodies. But it takes a long time to figure that out. And you need to get those drugs on board fairly quickly. Obviously, different states are in different stages of this surge. So it makes sense that states would do things on a state level or even on a local level. But right now, you know, if you look at the maps that various public health agencies are putting out, every state is having a surge. And I think I just saw a map today that said every single county is having a surge.
Let's talk about those monoclonal antibodies. These are treatments. They're pretty effective. I was looking at recommendations, though. You use a different one depending on which stage you are in the illness. Most of them require infusions where you got to get in and have them put them in you. You don't just get a quick shot. Texas saying it's out of one called Sotrovimab. Republican Governor Greg Abbott of Texas says the Biden administration is effectively hoarding these drugs, denying states independent access to these treatments. Do you see log jams in the world of monoclonal antibodies right now? Where are they coming from?
There are, and yet another problem is that it turns out there's three different monoclonal antibodies that are available. We've got this pill that's going to come online, but that's not available yet. It's still being, you know, it was just approved and it needs to be manufactured. So of the three that we had available, two of them don't work on the Omicron variant. So you not only need to test positive, you need to know which variant you have. And that's part of the reason why the federal government has been controlling the distribution of these monoclonal antibodies. But obviously, there is more demand right now than there is supply.
Now, there are also these antiviral treatments out there. Good news, but making things more complicated too. Are these getting to where they need to go?
Well, that's the pill that I was just talking
okay.
about. And they're right. And they are not yet because it's still too soon.
How about states when it comes to things like requiring vaccines or requiring vaccines or testing to do certain things or be in particular workplaces? There's a federal effort on that we'll talk to in a minute. What's the range of responses now at the state level?
Well, the range of responses is wide, and at the local level. There are states where some counties have mask mandates and some don't, and some businesses have vaccine mandates, and in some states businesses aren't allowed to have vaccine mandates. There's obviously a fight going on at the federal level. The Supreme Court this Friday will hear two cases about the federal vaccine mandates, so we should know in the fairly near future about those. But in the meantime, there's a lot of people who are still not vaccinated, and still walking around potentially vulnerable and potentially still spreading this illness.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Arthur is with us in Madison. Arthur, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, yeah. Arthur?
Well, my question was, why haven't the government kind of pushed the insurance companies to force vaccinations instead of just having them not really saying anything or not really doing anything right now? Why haven't they, you know, say either get vaccinated or you're not insured?
Arthur, thanks for the call. Julie, insurance companies, either a carrot or a stick, I guess. What's their role been? Could they do something like that?
I don't think insurance companies really want to be put in that position. I mean, there are obviously insurance companies that are health maintenance organizations like Kaiser Permanente, with which, by the way, Kaiser Health News is not affiliated, but they have sort of an interest in keeping you healthy. And they do, you know, they strongly urge things. They make it as easy as possible. Generally, the mandate requirements tend to come from government, not from private entities Although, as we see, some private businesses are requiring it too, but they're just saying, if you don't want to, you can only come into our business if you get vaccinated, not like the insurance company that says, if you don't get vaccinated, we're not going to cover you.
Arthur, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Brett in Elroy. Brett, hi.
Hey, I just wondered if you could touch on if we're seeing Omicron versus Delta in the hospitalizations right now. Early reports were stating that Omicron was more of upper respiratory, whereas Delta probably attacked deeper lung tissue. And if that makes a difference with the availability of monoclonal antibodies and why we're not seeing the antibodies distributed like we should.
Brett, thanks for the call. A lot of big questions, Julie, about Omicron versus Delta. What do we know so far about what Brett was asking about?
Well, there's so much that we don't know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the big things, first of all, we don't even know the case numbers that we have right now. We don't know how accurate those are, because now many people who can get these at-home tests are taking them. And if you test positive on an at-home test, unless you're going to call your doctor, there's no requirement that be reported. So there's probably many more positive tests and probably mild cases than we're seeing in those numbers. It is very hard to do the genetic work that it takes to differentiate one strain from another. Hospitals pretty much around the country are slammed right now, so it's hard to know whether you have Delta or Omicron, although I did today see that the CDC said that in the cases that they have been sequencing, Omicron is now 95% of the new cases.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about the various ways federal and state governments are fighting COVID-19. Julie Rovner is with us, chief Washington correspondent at Kaiser Health News, host there of the What the Health podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to President Biden saying, hey, it's mostly up to states to end the pandemic, though we, the federal government, are going to support your efforts? What kind of policies are you seeing at your local and county levels? Do you have a mask mandate in your community of any sort? Do you wish you did? Do you wish you didn't? What role should local governments, state governments be playing here? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about what federal, state, and local governments are able to do to manage COVID-19. President Biden recently said there's not one federal solution to ending the pandemic. A lot of the work has to happen at the state level. He said the feds would still play a supporting role. Julie Rovner stays with us. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And you could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the feds, from the state government, from your local or county government? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Judy is with us in Madison. Judy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about or tell us about, Judy?
Well, I'd just like to ask how she feels about creating these temporary tent facilities like they did when the pandemic initially broke out and hospitals were inundated with patients. So they created these alternative facilities. What does she feel about creating those for people who choose not to be vaccinated and are basically taking up all the space in the hospitals? And so people that have legitimate health concerns that need heart surgery, need any other kind of medical treatment that requires hospitalization would have a bed and they could be treated rather than sitting off and waiting until a bed opens up.
Judy, thanks for the call. Julie, the idea of field hospitals for COVID to relieve some of the pressure on hospitals, Judy suggesting mainly for the unvaccinated. What do you think?
Well, I don't know that they would be able to differentiate
right.
If somebody's brought in. And also, I mean, part of the problem with that is that if you have generally field hospitals for people who need less type of supportive care, it's pretty hard to have a lot of ventilators in field hospitals, although they did in New York. I mean, they set up a field hospital that they ended up not having to use where they did have ventilators. So it is possible. You know, one would hope it's not going to get to that. But certainly if you set up a field hospital, I don't think you would do it to try to segregate people by whether or not they were vaccinated, but by, you know, where their needs could be best served.
Thanks for that call, Judy. And that raises the issue, Julie, of the federal government helping with personnel, which is one of the big issues in overwhelmed hospitals. We've seen some federal relief coming to places like Green Bay, among others. How much more capacity, though, does the federal government have when it comes to sending medical personnel to help out in overburdened states?
Well, it's trying to. I mean, you know, obviously the National, as I said, the National Guard has been mobilized in many states to help with, you know, it's not just the doctors and the nurses and the medical professionals, but it's also the other people who keep the hospital running who may not be, you know, professionally, you know, medically trained, the people who do the food service and do the cleaning. And, you know, that everybody is exhausted. Everybody is catching COVID. And there is going to be need for help to basically prevent the nation's, you know, healthcare system, our healthcare delivery system, from crumbling under the strain. That's what the big concern has been.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Julie Rovner with Kaiser Health News, looking at the latest COVID-19 news and the division of labor. What can the federal government do? What can the state and local governments do? You could join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Jake is on the line in Madison. Jake, hello.
Hi. I just have a humble opinion, maybe, but I just wanted to state for people out there that when people are refusing to wear masks or refusing to get vaccinated, and they talk about their individual freedoms, that's not what it's about. They're making it about their selfishness and their lack of consideration for the community at large.
Jake, thanks for the call. Julie, before we get into some mask mandates, a related issue, what do you think of Jake's idea, selfishness versus public service? There's been concern that, yeah, we haven't really thought about each other in some ways in our response as individuals to the pandemic.
Well, this has been the debate all along. When does our responsibility to our fellow citizens, you know, override our desire and need for personal freedom? And, you know, I've seen this compared to so many things, although one of the more effective comparisons I saw today was, you know, if a bunch of people are together on a boat and somebody pokes a hole in the bottom of his stateroom floor, and other people might complain, but they're all literally in the same boat. And if the boat sinks, they're all going down. This is a debate. It's hardly new. It's, you know, we've seen a lot of it in this pandemic, but it's hardly new when people's individual rights sort of butt up against the needs of a community at large.
And then with mask mandates, Julie, the statewide mandate's been long gone here in Wisconsin after a court ruling. County mask mandates few and far between here. What is the state of the art when it comes to mandating masks around the country?
Well, and complicating this even more, and it, in most states, it's the same. There are few state mask mandates left because they've been so unpopular. I live in a county where there is a mask mandate, but now what the experts are saying, particularly with Omicron, is because it is so much more contagious that you need a better mask, that actually people should be wearing better than cloth masks or even better than surgical masks. And that's something that it's been very difficult to get through to people. You know, they've had these masks and they've been wearing them and they've been fine up until now because we haven't been dealing with a variant that is this contagious. So it's not just a matter of whether or not to wear a mask, but what kind of mask to wear.
We heard from Matt in Wausau who emails, our dealing with COVID has been the worst in the world. We've been in this 2 years and still don't have enough masks, tests, vaccines, hospital beds, nurses, doctors. Matt says for-profit healthcare is literally killing us. I don't know, Julie, what do you think about that comparison on the world stage of the U.S. performance on COVID?
I've been watching other countries, what they've been doing too, and nobody really seems to have the magic answer to how to do this right. I mean, our public health system is pretty much as public as most other countries' public health systems. Where we differ is that our delivery system is private, and many other countries don't have private delivery systems, although some other countries do. Canada does. It's just I think there's been everybody's exhausted around the world and there's been pushback everywhere. I'm not suggesting for a minute that we've done a great job, but when I look around, we obviously have plenty of company among countries that haven't done a great job either.
Time for one more caller. Michael is with us in Northwest Wisconsin. Michael, hi.
Hi, I am a student at UW-Madison, and obviously Dane County has a mask mandate. And I'm just wondering, with the campus having about 96% student vaccination, I'm just wondering to what extent or what degree masks are important and should be required on campus, you know?
Michael, thanks for the call. I work in a UW-Madison-owned building, and there's a sign, mask required regardless of vaccination status. Julie, in a high vaccine environment, do mask mandates still make sense, Michael wonders?
In an Omicron environment, they do, because we're seeing lots and lots of people who are fully vaccinated and boosted getting COVID. They're not getting severe cases, but they're getting it. And if you get it, you can spread it. So again, this is you would like to protect yourself if you can. And being vaccinated, you're not necessarily fully protected. And you would like to protect others who might not be vaccinated and might be more vulnerable.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Julie, we've covered a lot of ground, heard from a lot of great questions from listeners. What do you have your eye on now with so much going on?
I think, you know, there's every expectation that this is going to spike up really fast and then perhaps go down really fast. I am most worried about the ability of the healthcare system just to keep running. I'm really worried about these people who've been, you know, working nonstop for 2 years and who are exhausted and just drained, and whether they're going to be able to handle this, and about people who have other health problems. I think one of the callers mentioned this, that, you know, if you have a heart attack, or, you know, we had a snowstorm here in Washington, D.C. this week, where we're not really used to it. And, you know, you can fall and slip on the ice and break something and need to go to the hospital that's all full of COVID patients. So that's kind of my biggest concern right now.
Just very briefly, Julie, do you worry about long-term impact on personnel, the doctors, the nurses, and others? Maybe this is going to drive some of them out of the profession?
I do. I mean, I worry about sort of the state of our medical care system going forward. There's a lot of people, young people stepping up who want to get into it, which is a good thing. But I just, you know, while those people are getting trained, I worry about people who are sort of nearing retirement saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. And us having, you know, a really severe shortage of healthcare personnel.
Julie, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, host of KHN's What the Health podcast. We talked to her about President Biden saying COVID needs to be solved mostly at the state level and what federal, state, and local governments are doing to help. Now, listening to music might be something you do all the time. On the radio when you're driving, watching a movie when that score starts to play. Maybe you've started seeing your favorite bands live in concert again, in person or online. Our next guests say all of these musical activities have a connection to our well-being, and they say music can be a big force for good as we grow older. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What connection does music have to your life? Is there a song, a band, an album that makes you feel better when you listen to it? How's your relationship with music changed throughout your life? Do you play music? Do you think it has some kind of a therapeutic value for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dean Vondras is a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and Scott Mady is an emeritus professor of psychology at Shippensburg University. They're the authors of the new book, Music, Wellness, and Aging, Defining, Directing, and Celebrating Life. There's an accompanying YouTube series of play-along music you can listen to as well. Dean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
And Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, Scott, I think a lot of us may know we like music and might make us feel a little happier. This connection to health, though, especially as we age, before we get into some of the details about how that works, how big a deal can music be when it comes to healthy aging?
It can be quite a big deal. I think it helps us in a number of ways when it comes to our health. Not only gives us an emotional release, it helps our moods. It also motivates us to engage in behaviors. We see that in exercise behavior and a whole host of things. It also connects us to other people that can also be a support network for us.
And Dean, we'll talk mostly about music, but I want to talk a little about aging, because one point that keeps coming out through your book is sometimes we think of aging as a pathology, a series of illnesses and declines and things like that. And you are, I think, really trying to make us think about it in a different way as a life change that we can adapt to in better or worse ways. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, music tells a story about life, and we see it as a window to look into what's going on in adulthood, what's going on in later life. So it reveals to us, music does, aspects about ourselves in particular ways that we don't often maybe recognize or reflect upon, and it sort of directs our focus now on aging, our concern about getting older and what later life is, to onto those things. And so music becomes a special window to for us, allows us to look at aging in a humanistic way. And I think in that sense, we can take advantage of what it means to be a person at midlife or in later adulthood, how we're becoming yet, how we can see old age beyond the idea or framework of biological decline, to see it as still an experience, an opportunity for new growth, new understanding of self, new experiences in life.
Scott, can you talk some about the connection between music and memory in particular?
Well, memories, yes, simply put, is quite complex. But one way we can think of music and memory is how it helps us in terms of our, if we play music, how we can remember the pieces we play, how we learn an instrument. When it comes to our listening, how does music spark emotions, memories for past events, and those types of things. Yeah, we certainly have areas of the brain, of course, that have been shown to reflect memory stores. And so, we have implicit memories, for instance, that allows us to play an instrument. When we use an explicit memory, if we're trying to learn a piece of music or actually playing the music, we have what's called a musical memory area of the brain that basically seems to be somewhat the last bastion of memory systems for music when we have experienced things like dementia. So it's been found to be its own kind of storage place for music. So all of these are related to memory, and then certainly we can talk more about how we can improve our memories for music, like if we're practicing, for instance, like common things like chunking and block practices versus random practicing and phrasing of musical phrases and, starting slow with strategies.
Well, Dean, I want to stick with memory. I'm doing an experiment on myself in some ways. I just sorted through my CD collection. I stopped buying CDs many years ago. As I listen to things, it's this window into my life then. How much does the music we listen to at different ages help us, maybe as we grow older, connect to that past self of ours?
Good question. Well, keep buying the CDs, keep listening to
I stream new stuff, but yeah.
Yeah, and there's so much, if you like experimental music, new music, new kinds of music, I think it starts to allow us to think again about life experiences, if you will, and connect that way. So music is invigorating in lots of ways. Certainly cognitively, it sort of opens up our thinking a little bit more, if you will, allows us to make those kinds of connections. And I think if you're thinking about the yourself in development and considering how you heard the music at an earlier time in life and how you hear it now, maybe there's a new interpretation for you. You can hear an old song and think of it in a new way. Maybe a song you didn't recognize or like very much now is a favorite song for you. I think, as we think about other kinds of music from throughout the world and different sorts of genre, we can, take advantage of trying out some of these new sounds and seeing ourselves maybe within that cultural setting. That's, an opportunity to, expand and grow in kind of a cognitive psychological way, perhaps, making new connections like that. But also, I think, in terms of how we see ourselves in the broader sphere of what the world is to us as we get older. When we're younger, as adolescents and young adults, we're probably pretty egocentric. Everything's about us, and we're filtering it through our particular lens. But at midlife and in old age, the new adventure is to see ourselves in this collective cross-cultural way, to see the commonalities we share with people from all different kinds of backgrounds. And I think that can take us into lots of new kinds of reflections about how we are and who we are. So those old CDs, those old songs, I think reflect our history, reflect our past, were part of our milestones in growing up. And I think we can cherish those and celebrate those still in later life.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
Hi. An artist that spans many genres who just brings a joy to my heart every time I hear him sing is Van Morrison. Just something about doesn't have the best voice in the world, but he moves through it and just everything. He scat swords, everything I've ever heard from his, it just made me smile.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Indeed, a phrase used, brings joy to my heart. Could you talk about the solace, the joy that music can offer, which is a big part of our well-being?
Yeah, music has this quality. It has this effect. It's a phenomena that embraces us. We're immersed in that sound. It's almost like the music has the same qualities of wonderful and beautiful voices, as the caller mentioned, that somehow, pierce through and touch us at our most inner point. And since ancient times, this has been recognized that this particular sound, a particular timbre of an instrument or a person's voice just seemed to elicit from us certain kinds of feelings of happiness, joy, comfort even, to all those positive kinds of emotions that we might express. But I think, there's something to that, that as we age, especially get older and have this opportunity to reflect, to say, what I'm hearing, I can hear in a new way too. I can, when I was younger, didn't have a great love for the fourth grade band, which plays in unison usually and out of tune, and it sounds very interesting. But now, later in life, I'm thinking that's one of the most beautiful sounds and beautiful symbolisms of what we do as a community. The teacher hoping for the students to do their best, the students following that instruction so carefully and trying their best. And at that moment, I think that is a beautiful music too. So even, you don't have to play all the right notes, but it's what we do collectively to, communicate. Music's a language that tells us about ourselves, and we can speak about our culture, our social circumstance, about our hopes, about our love. So all kinds of things. I mentioned positive concerns, but, there are all other aspects of our emotions too that we find also represented musically.
Talking to Scott Mady and Dean Vondras. They're the authors, co-authors of the new book, Music, Wellness, and Aging, Defining, Directing, and Celebrating Life. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find that music has an impact, a benefit for your emotional well-being, your mental health, maybe even your physical well-being? Do you lean on music when you exercise, when you need a boost in your mood, or somebody to commiserate with you in the bad mood? Been listening to that new Adele album a lot lately, for example. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you broke up, I recommend it. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion about the role of music in all stages of our lives, especially as we age. Our guests are Dean Vondras from UW-Green Bay, Scott Mady from Shippensburg University. They're authors of the new book, Music, Wellness, and Aging, Defining, Directing, and Celebrating Life. You can call in with your thoughts on what music means to you, what benefits it has to you, the joy it brings, maybe the healthier emotional and mental well-being along with it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hey, Dean and Scott, right?
That's right, yeah.
Hey, great. I remembered. I'm a senior citizen in my upper 60s, and I have just so much enjoyed your presentation on the radio today. I plan to get your book and read it. I have never learned to play a musical instrument, but I think I'm going to try that. I'm a big lover of music. Anyhow, I thank you so much for your presentation. I wanted to make one comment.
Sure.
That's kind of funny, where you had mentioned opening your mind to new genres of music, right? And recently, I discovered this, I think it's called EDM, electronic dance music.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Well, I never really listened to that. I just didn't, you know, I never went to a rave or took ecstasy or any of that. But I stream it on my Bose headphones while I'm doing housework. And it is just amazing how much housework I can get done.
I love it.
It's kind of like it matches a certain vibration, or it just communicates to me well, where I get into action and before you know it, the house is clean.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, drum and bass DJ sets on YouTube have gotten me through the pandemic. A search Delta Heavy, Mike, on a DJ set on YouTube. I think you'll be rewarded. So I love that that Mike is discovering new music. Dean, he opened himself up to a whole new genre. I don't know. I feel like our brains are growing as we discover new music.
Oh, there's so much music to listen to, electronic music. What's not to love about that? The excitement, the rhythmic pulse. It's, you know, one of the neurological things that occurs is the, you know, coalescence of the tempo of the music with neuroelectrical activity of the brain that starts to get things in sync. So in our book, we discuss this phenomena. And, you know, there's a song by Kiki D Band called I've Got the Music in Me. So gives us a whole new understanding what's going on as we listen to music, how it really, you know, penetrates into us. It overtakes our own neurological kinds of functions and starts to move us in a particular way, we think, at least from that kind of neurological evidence. So I think there's lots there to consider. And again, all kinds of music. And, you know, if you're not, haven't played a musical instrument before, just listening to music, I think is something that anybody can do, and everybody can do that. But playing simple, you know, picking a simple instrument, you know, if you tap your foot, keep beat somehow as you listen to music, you're already a drummer. So maybe we're all born drummers to begin with. So I think there's all kinds of access points for people to find to become involved in music, and listening and appreciating and going to concerts and talking about it are ways to become involved in that social experience that music affords us.
Yeah, and Scott, Mike had mentioned he's thinking of learning a new instrument in his late 60s, I think he said. I think a lot of people would say, oh, no way, it's too late for me. We could still get a lot out of learning an instrument at any age, right?
Yeah, yes, correct. Yeah, just to borrow a phrase, just do it. you know, and as Dean mentioned, sometimes, you know, a simpler instrument is a good place to start. You know, a recorder, a little drum pad. But, you know, start listening to music. And by doing that, listen to what maybe strikes you, that you find a particular instrument that you find interesting to hear. And that may be the one that you want to gravitate toward to learn. You know, there's no prescription, there's no formula to pick up an instrument. I think any of us that played an instrument do look back and say, how did I pick that up? And how did I stick with it? So I don't think there's really any sort of thing you can tell someone. Is just do it, I guess, is what I would say.
Thanks again for that call. Good luck with the musical instrument learning. We're talking to Scott Mady and Dean Vondras, co-authors of the new book, Music, Wellness, and Aging. Back to your calls now. Matt is with us in Green Bay. Matt, hi.
Hey, I have autism.
Uh-huh.
I love 80s music.
Do you have a favorite, Matt?
usually I like Aha.
Okay.
I usually like Dua Lipa.
And I gotta ask, Matt, did you grow up in the '80s or did you discover it even though you're younger than that?
I'm 13 years old.
13. Okay. Yeah, this is, Matt, I'll point you in a direction. Find Gary Newman from the 1980s, and he's still doing music now, and it's still good. Matt, thank you so much for sharing that. I love it. Dean Matt sought out music from a previous generation. He said he's 13, he has autism, and he's getting a lot of benefit from the music that I'll admit I grew up with.
Yeah, it's interesting that we could... We hear music, and maybe some of the best music is the older music from the 80s. And again, the particular orchestration, the style of music that speaks to us now, you know, in the 21st century. So, my son is into music from the 90s. Now we're listening to music from the 60s and Woodstock era. So I don't know how far we'll go back. You know, Scott plays music that goes back to the 20s and 30s, and so do I. And it's still great music. So why not play it? Why not listen to it? And to kind of, again, think about playing musical instruments, harmonica is a great instrument to pick up, and you can get the blues harmonica and always sound great, usually. Play along with the radio, play along with the Spotify. So there's always all kinds of ways to be involved. I should mention, too, that joining a community choir, a community band, is kind of interesting. And Scott belongs to one in Pennsylvania. He actually is in a couple of different groups. But the director there that we this interviewed for the book, he mentions that when we think about community music and how it's a point of access for folks, it's an open audition. Everybody can come. And the catchphrase that's used that I really like is, you know, your best is good enough. There's always opportunity to learn. So everybody can be involved.
Thanks again for that call. Scott, we just have a couple minutes left now. We've covered some of this now, but what kind of things are you hoping people take away from this book when it comes to their relationship with music?
Well, I think, a couple of sort of my closing ideas are play more, become involved with music. As we mentioned, pick up an old instrument if you haven't played in a while. Get out your vinyl records, you know, get out your CDs, get out your old tape players if you still have something that can play them. Pick up a new instrument, as Mike said, or join a choir or a vocal group. So get involved in music that way. Listen to music. Hopefully the book will inspire people to do that. There's no matter where you live, there are free concerts, there are performances, local high schools, colleges, concerts in the park. So I think the book, you know, focuses on this sort of phenomenology, this experience we have with music, this joy and this transcendence, this movement beyond just our everyday lives to something special. And I think that's hopefully what people will take away from this book.
Well, we'll leave it there. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
And Dean, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
That was Scott Mady of Shippensburg University in Pennsylvania and Dean Vondras from UW-Green Bay. They're with us today to talk about their new book. It's called Music, Wellness, and Aging, Defining, Directing, and Celebrating Life. You can find a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time and look for that title, Music, Wellness, and Aging, on YouTube if you'd like. They've got playlists that go along with a lot of the points they make along the way in the book.